This is Life 103.1. I'm Alan Button, welcoming you on behalf of all of us here at the station to a special Christmas feature recently recorded in our studio. What follows in our usual Grace Notes time slot this week is a conversation that I had last week with Lynn Buzzard, who in addition to being a husband, father, and grandfather, has served at various times as a pastor, founding executive director of the Christian Legal Society, Campbell Law Professor, and Dean of Hongdong International Law School. He is also an author, and it's in that capacity that we invited him to visit with us last week. It's our pleasure to have with me in the studio today a longtime friend, Lynn Buzzard, who's got a resume that maybe we won't get into, but he comes well qualified from a lot of different directions to read what we've invited him to read. He's graciously accepted our invitation. Lynn wrote something a number of years ago. We'll have him give a little history about it here shortly, but wrote something a number of years ago that I was privileged to hear him read a number of years ago, and we've asked him if he wouldn't mind reading it for our audience here at the station at Life 103.1. Lynn, welcome.
Well, thank you. It's always encouraging when someone wants to invite you to read something they wrote.
Well, as I told you, Lynn, in my text message, I have for a lot of years now thought about the piece that you've written, and it has helped me think about the awe with which anybody who considers seriously the events of Christmas, it's helped me a lot to think about and envision and realize something of the significance of that first Christmas.
Yeah, as I looked at my own script here and noted 1978.
Uh-huh.
So I can't tell you I have vivid memories about the night I wrote about the night before Christmas, except that I do recall that this was not something that you went through 10 or 15 editorial adjustments and striking this line and adding this one, and I didn't have anybody else as sort of an editor. I wasn't doing it for some publication that was going to hack it up. And I do recall that I had a sense of flow as I was doing this. And as I was reading it just yesterday in preparation for coming in, I was reminded that it was almost a spontaneous thing that as I thought about it, I don't want to claim that, some spirit was giving me the script, but there's a sense in which, as I read it now, it reads like something I didn't do. In the sense that I did feel a sense of inspiration and challenge as I thought about the context of, as the whole reading gets to, what was the real night before Christmas, not the one we think about, wrapping gifts. And as you point out, anytime you try to imagine kind of celestial conversations or transactions among angels and God's spirit. I mean, we're in a world of mystery beyond our ability to even script. But I did feel that it was very meaningful to me.
Yep.
And I guess that's the first thing about really any good sermon or book you write. If you are at its most powerful product, maybe you ought not to write it. So, you know, I had that kind of feeling rereading it, that, you know, there are elements of this, of the spiritual world, which we can only kind of imagine with human analogies. But we're invited to do that by the incarnation.
Well, Lynn, thank you again for being here. Let's see, if you're ready, we'll have you start. And
okay.
By way of further introduction, Lynn's piece here is entitled The First Night Before Christmas, written in 1978 and with a life of its own for many years since then.
And it starts with a familiar quotation from our history, but goes off the rails after that.
Take it away.
'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. Now, far be it from me to raise doubts about so noble and certified a tradition as told by this rhyme, which has mesmerized so many a cuddly child. But to be quite frank, the author was never in my house on the night before Christmas. I can't speak for all the mice who may indeed not be stirring, but all else is a little less than an uproar. It may be a holy night, but it is not a silent night. The kids, if not in bed, are clearly hyper, and if one has managed to spirit them away to bed, one knows it won't be for long. They'll be calling out. As for me, I'm invariably caught short of an adequate supply of D-cell batteries for toys with a half-life of a little more than 2 hours. I'm further invariably finding myself mumbling in disgust as I'm ensconced on the living room floor, vainly trying to interpret the, quote, easy-to-follow directions on all those assembly-required bargains, or trying to fold along all the dotted lines and insert flap A into slot B. All of this, combined with frustrations with tearing cellophane tape created surely by demons, and wrapping paper rip-off rolls only a yard long, are enough to ruin the all is calm of the night before Christmas. Sugar plums, whatever in the world those are, may dance in the heads of children all snuggled in bed, but headaches are a little more my style. Such, sadly, is the final end of the countdown of shopping days left till Christmas and the invasion of blue light specials. But, you know, I wonder. I mean, on those occasions I can escape from the incessant noise and the compulsive demands of Christmas, when I can ignore the tendency to take Christmas so for granted simply because it always seems to be there about the 25th. On those occasions, I do wonder, what was the night before Christmas really like? I mean, the real Christmas, the very first one, the surprising one, the shocking one, the one that caught the world off guard on a sleepy winter night, the one before Tonka toys or perfumes by Machiavelli, Bank AmeriCards and endless Christmas specials on red-nosed reindeer and floppy-eared donkeys. What was the night before Christmas really like 2 millennia ago? Now, I'm not thinking about Rome or Jerusalem or even Little Bethlehem. Life there was, I'm sure, boringly routine on that night before Christmas. Soldiers probably drank a final toast and staggered off to quarters. Priests may have gestured over their basins of water one more time. Families fought or laughed, as the case may be, and argued over who would snuff out the oil lamps, snuggled themselves in layered protection against the cold winter wind, and dreamed their private neuroses they'd nurtured for years. No, I'm not very curious about the night before Christmas. For proud Romans, obedient and routinized Pharisees, tradition-bound Sadducees, or even plain old country folk. But I do wonder about the night before Christmas and what it was like in the very councils of heaven. Surely, if the night before Christmas is worth knowing about at all, if it can speak to me of more than fantasy, if it offers a glimmer of light or a glimpse of purpose into this spinning mass of matter in an endless universe, then that is the night I would know of. Enough of sugar plums and stockings hung with care and jolly old Saint Nick. Tell instead a word of truth. Take me to the center of the cosmic plan. Let me eavesdrop just for a moment. Let me catch a hushed word, or let me sense a mood, or touch a feeling from the first, the real first night before Christmas. Do you sense it? What of the angels on that night before Christmas? I suspect, quite frankly, they're a little confused. The choirs are ready, no doubt, been so perhaps for centuries, and been waiting expectantly to perform their song of joyful exultation, their hymn of announcement. And they probably have some notion of what's about to happen, but still, it's really quite beyond their celestial minds to grasp. To fathom what's about to happen. Oh, not because they don't know love. Why, they live in it, exist in it as we do in air, and not because they're unaware of sin. They know of rebellion. They've seen it in their own ranks, though eons ago now. But human? They're not at all sure what that's about. And notions of salvation and redemption, though they've heard the words, are really quite foreign to their experience. So I suspect, in their confusion, they intensified their idle chatter, as humans do. And the more officious and nervous ones scurried about constantly checking music and travel arrangements, or tuning their harps or whatever instruments such creatures play. But in the inner councils, in the very presence of the Father, Son, and Spirit, was no hurriedness, no confusion, but a full understanding of what the night before Christmas was all about. What did they speak of? What did they do or feel? Forgive me for my anthropomorphism. I know of no other way to think or speak. And since I'm made in their image, perhaps it's not so much an error as you might think. Maybe anthropomorphic is more theomorphic than we ever dreamed. What was it like in the councils of heaven? I think 'twas surely in part a night of eager and joyous expectation. Even anticipation for this event had been planned for ages. And now, just precisely now, the time was right. What a later writer would call the fullness of time. This was the time. The time the prophets had foretold. The time visionaries had seen, however blurringly. the time of which dreamers dreamt. It was like the focal point for all the radii of the divine will, radii that stretched back to the garden and the serpent, radii that leapt from burning bushes in the desert and rose from incense offered in temple opulence, radii that came from Abraham's bosom in a wilderness tent, and from Solomon's glory. Radii that traced the map of the Middle East from Pharaoh's Egypt to tribal Canaan. Yes, the time was here. The night before Christmas was one of hope and readiness. The Father, Son, and Spirit felt its electricity. But I hope it will not seem impious to suggest that the night before Christmas in the heavenly councils was more than joy and hope, more than simply a packet of bags and a fare thee well and an announcement that it's about time. No, this incarnation is too overwhelming, too shocking, too drastic, yes, even too dangerous and risky for any such casualness, however long it had been planned. It was not, you see, simply an act in a cosmic drama to be played out on Earth's stage and then with a falling curtain to receive applause and return to real life. No, this was very real. The Son, the very Word of God, the one present from the foundation of the world, one whose very name was holy, the one who'd always lived in the glory and fullness of whatever bliss heaven holds, one who enjoyed all the perquisites of Godhead, one who lived in the constant love of the Father and the Spirit, one who in our finiteness to try to grasp, we invent helpless words like omnipresent, omniscient, eternal. All theologians may speak easily of the incarnation, thinking, as humans are wont to do, that if they give something a name, they've explained it and encompassed it. But how foolish. Who can grasp the Godhead squalling in a manger, feeling cold and crying for milk from its mother's breast? Christians smile at manger scenes made of plastic, wood, and clay, scenes invariably clean and neat, ridden of waste and stench and pain. How foolish such attempts to fathom the great invasion, the astonishing and shocking miracle. God became man. God was about to be born, and he'd never been born before. He was to become man, and though he had created man and loved man, he'd never been man before. So you see, I think the night before Christmas in the councils of heaven was no mere joyful farewell at the arrival of the long-awaited time. No, as much as joy and hope there was, I'm sure the talk of pain and risk that night. Oh, you doubt me? Then think of what it means to set aside the glory that was his, the power, the love, the honor set aside, the riches of eternal joy. Set it all aside for human toil and pain, trade in the glory and choose a cross and drink a cup in a garden all alone. Oh, I think the Father, Son, and Spirit walked silently the cosmic shores that night and spoke of the costliness of love about to be born. Perhaps they whispered of the taunting crowds, the hostile leaders, the foolishness of fickle masses, a jeering throng and gambling soldiers. Perhaps they spoke in broken voice of their own coming separation, they who'd never been apart before. Did they speak of the loneliness that would be felt? a loneliness to ultimately reach its screaming peak in the darkness of a Friday storm hanging over a hill by the name of Skull outside the city over which he'd weep. Oh, the costs and risks of love reaching out in time and space as when God becomes a man. Did they not surely speak of risking love that night? For can the Father's love, though surely richer and fuller than ours might be, not be marked like ours with the risk of rejection and denial? To love, to care, to reach out, is it not an invitation, a request that another might receive with joy or choose to spurn? Is not love itself a risk, an openness to pain and hurt? We see it in ourselves so clear, how difficult it is for us to truly love, to let a portion of ourselves flow toward another, to invest ourselves, because that other person may refuse, may laugh, may ridicule and scoff. Oh, when we're young and foolish, we say, I love you, to many persons. It flows easily from almost any base. But when a little older and hopefully a little wiser, we know both more of what to love might mean and know as well the hurt that love spurned can give. So we say, I love you, almost not at all. To offer love must be something like the dazzling act of the entertainer swinging on the high trapeze under the giant center tent, like that moment when the performer must let go of the swinging bar and turn to reach another. There is no luxury allowed of holding on to the first while firmly grasping the second. No, you must let go. You must go through the threatening moments, suspended in air, risking disaster beneath. Was the night before Christmas like that? A moment of threatened suspension? Here was love about to happen in the loudest form ever. Perhaps? No. In fact, certainly. God loved when he created. And perhaps there was love in the giving of the law in the storm upon the mountain. And even there must have been love in the sternness of those prophetic denunciations. But now, in a new way, in an irrefutable way, love was being declared. Love was stepping directly into our lives. And what would man do with it? It was not a noisy party that night before Christmas. Rather, I think, a quiet one. Like all the deepest feelings, they best are said in the softest tones, and even without words at all. Words become flesh. And so the silence spoke of love between them flowing, and the silence spoke of all that was to come. And sometime during that night, the Father, Son, and Spirit embraced long and hard in their oneness. And all creation trembled with excitement, and the starry host prepared its tribute, and hell shook in fear. For Mary and Joseph were expectant. Simeon and Anna were waiting, and wise men were searching, and shepherds needed awakening to life, and Zacchaeus longed to escape his drudgery, and blind Bartimaeus, strange to see, and others all through the ages are waiting too, and soldiers wait as well. So a baby cried, and the Word became flesh.
The First Night Before Christmas by Lynn Buzzard. Thank you, Lynn. I spoke with Lynn again earlier this week and told him we'd like to close with a Christmas carol or song that might be especially meaningful to him. He mentioned Mary, Did You Know? and said he thought that song actually seemed to fit pretty well with the theme of what he imagined as the first night before Christmas. And I think he's right about that. So, here it is. And Merry Christmas from all of us here at Life 103.1. A beautiful version of Mary Did You Know by Kathy Mattea.
Mary, did you know?